two of the figures that could certainly be added to the Nietzsche's favorites and targets list are the figures of Darwin, whom we mentioned, and Hegel, whom we did not. What they have in common is the fact that they both take history very seriously. Hegel, in fact, comes just an inch away from discovering the theory of evolution back in roughly 1805 or so, when in his Philosophy of Nature, he suggests that different species represent different levels of creation. But at the same time, he, in an unfortunate footnote, says that this should not be construed as a kind of temporal sequence. And with that unfortunate footnote, he probably shut himself out of scientific history. But point is that both Hegel and Darwin saw, in some sense, history as important, and secondly, the multiplicity of species as significant. And to an extent to which I think Nietzsche doesn't always appreciate, both of them were powerful influences on him. As for the attention to history, Nietzsche says in an early book, Human, All Too Human, what he calls the original error of philosophers. He says, all philosophers share this common error. They proceed from the contemporary man and think they can reach the goals through an analysis of this man. Automatically, they think man is an eternal verity, as something abiding in the whirlpool, as a sure measure of things. Lack of historical sense is the original error of all philosophers. It's an error that was clearly not committed by Hegel or by Darwin. And I think it's important to understand both why Nietzsche seems to ignore them, or at any rate degrade them, and also why he is so indebted to them. Let's start with Hegel. Truth is that Nietzsche probably did not read much Hegel, and he knew of Hegel only through the kind of conversations that philosophers might have in the halls. The problem was that Hegel, after his death in 1831, was followed by two very different movements, which are referred to using the terms from the French Revolution, which we still use in politics today, the left and the right. The left-wing Hegelians were people like Karl Marx. As a young man, he had gone to Berlin, where Hegel taught. He just missed Hegel by a few years. But he was very taken with Hegel's philosophy. From Hegel, he picked up the notion of the dialectic. He picked up the notion of classes, in effect, reversing themselves through history, and that in itself would be a whole course. But the truth is that that the left-wing Hegelians had better things to do, like start revolutions, so they were very quickly eliminated from the academic scene and were not in a position of teaching and were not in a position of spreading Hegel's reputation. On the other hand, the right-wing Hegelians were those who found Hegel's, let's call it, unorthodoxy, a little bit too much. And while Hegel himself, I think, can be argued to be not a very good Christian, in fact, actually a very secular Christian who had a good deal to say against Christianity, as Nietzsche did, the right-wing Hegelians made him into something very different. They pushed him more and more towards Lutheran orthodoxy, so that the Hegel Nietzsche knew through the conversations and the books of his time probably would have been very heavily Christian, and the notion of the spirit, which is Hegel's central notion, would have been interpreted very literally as the Lutheran Holy Spirit. And for that reason, Nietzsche would have rejected him. But I think there's a grand misinterpretation here. It is true that Hegel makes allusions to the Christian Holy Spirit, and part of this was that Hegel had an important professorship in Berlin. He wanted to keep it. And you couldn't be an anti-Christian and a professor in Germany, as some of his contemporaries found out. But it's pretty clear from what Hegel writes, and especially other things we know about him, that he took all this rather tongue-in-cheek and not too seriously. That in fact, spirit is, for him, a kind of cosmic consciousness. It is strictly this-worldly and not otherworldly. And in that, he has a great deal to say that Nietzsche would agree with. But most importantly, Hegel had a historical sense. In fact, it's sometimes been said, as a bit of an exaggeration, that Hegel invented history. And I think it's important to understand exactly what that means. Of course, there have been historians since ancient times. There were no doubt chroniclers in the most ancient of civilizations. Herodotus and Thucydides in particular come to mind in Greece, and they were very, very good historians. And Aristotle reports, not entirely accurately, but at least with some energy on the predecessors that he followed, and looks at his own philosophy as a kind of synthesis of earlier philosophical work, as, by the way, did Hegel look at his own work as the synthesis of all the philosophy that had gone before. But with Herodotus and Thucydides, what we find is that while they're historians, they're basically reporting pretty much on what's going on in their own time. And with Aristotle, when he talks about the pre-Socratic philosophers and talks about Plato, he's talking about not so much things that are very recent, but in any case, ideas which he can read as meshing pretty well with his own. What he doesn't really have is a keen sense of the passage of time, and with the passage of time, change through time. Now, Aristotle was, unlike Plato and Socrates and many of the pre-Socratics, a very much an advocate of the notion of change, which earlier philosophers thought was unreal. Aristotle, by contrast, thought that change is part of the essence of things. Nevertheless, there's a sense in which one might say, accurately, that Aristotle didn't have a real historical sense. In fact, if we go through the Middle Ages, well, again, there are many chroniclers and reporters, what we find is that the sense of history has not yet taken hold. And if we go into modern philosophy, you find Descartes and Kant in particular writing quite clearly about eternal truths and the question of whether truth changes through time, whether philosophical concepts develop through time. These are questions which are not actively raised. Hegel, for the first time, raises them and makes them the central focus. This is a thesis, of course, that is very close to Nietzsche's heart. Nietzsche talks a great deal about what he calls genealogy, tracing the origins of things, in particular the origins of ideas and of words. And it's really Hegel, back 80 years before Nietzsche, who is working these same ideas out, who is trying to come to an understanding of how things came to be as they are, with the very clear idea that they haven't always been this way, that the truth about history is the truth of change. What's more, with Hegel we get something that Nietzsche also would have admired, what becomes in Nietzsche the doctrine of perspectivism, but let's just give it the more neutral name, pluralism, the idea that there are many truths, and that these many truths can contradict each other. What Hegel does is he gives us a view of multiple, what he calls, forms of consciousness. Some of them are scientific, some of them are aesthetic, some of them are religious, some of them are straightforwardly philosophical. But the idea is that there are lots of ways of viewing the world, and it's not just a question of which ones are right and which ones are wrong, but rather, which ones are more developed, which ones are more naive, which ones are one-sided, which ones take account of the others more adequately. In short, what we get is a picture of various perspectives through which we see the world, and this is a doctrine which is very close to Nietzsche. What's more, these ideas are very much in conflict, and Nietzsche's notion of the agonistic society, which he saw in ancient Greece, Nietzsche's idea of a dialectic, which was the confrontation of different groups, of different ideas, of different feelings. This is something that comes straight out of Hegel, and one wonders why Nietzsche wasn't more appreciative of it, and I think the reason, again, is because this isn't the aspect of Hegel that was highlighted in his time. Perhaps most importantly, however, is a metaphor that Hegel uses in the preface of one of his greatest books, The Phenomenology of Spirit, in which he refers to the truth and philosophy in general as a Bacchanalian revel. Well, it doesn't take any stretch of the imagination or literary knowledge to see that the Bacchanalian metaphor is of a piece with Nietzsche's Dionysian metaphor, that Hegel, like Nietzsche, saw philosophy not as a neat linear progression, not as a mere matter of rational thinking, but rather as a kind of passionate mess. In fact, Hegel's philosophy is sometimes talked about as in terms of the logic of passion, indicating that it's not linear, indicating that it's not straightforwardly rational, indicating that it is very complicated and in many ways unresolved. All of this, of course, is clouded by the fact that Hegel insists, as a follower of Kant, that what he's doing is tracing nothing other than the history of rationality, and that the whole business is rational. In fact, he even calls it, like Kant, as Kant does, a deduction. And he's tapping the whole thing off with the notion of the absolute, or absolute knowing, of course, throws everything into disarray. The truth is that the absolute for Hegel is really just a kind of way of finishing up. It's not a way of striking the end of history or the end of philosophy or really the end of anything else. And in Nietzsche, it becomes very clear that what Hegel has done, in fact, is open the way for an entirely new kind of philosophy. Going back to the notion of history, though, what is most important in Hegel's notion of history is that philosophers conflict and they build on one another. And when we look back at the history of philosophy or the history of religion, the history of art, or history itself, what we see in every case is how things not just happen once, disappear, and are replaced with something else, but rather how they build on each other in a kind of patterned way. This is not to say, as Hegel does, that there's a purpose behind it all, a teleology, a thesis which Schopenhauer, for one, had firmly rejected, and we saw in the last lecture that Nietzsche finds it also rejected in Spinoza. But basically, the idea of something emerging in a pattern-like way is something that Nietzsche clearly sees himself, and that's what his genealogy, in particular, will be all about. Regarding Darwin, there's another mix of messages here, and some of the things that Nietzsche says about Darwin are faintly praising. Others are very condemning. In his last book, his autobiography, Nietzsche accuses his fellow scholars of scholarly oxen have suspected me of Darwinism, which he considered obviously an insult. The idea of being associated with Darwin gets confusing for many of us because when we look at Darwin, as I just said for Hegel, what we tend to see are affinities. For one thing, Darwin is a naturalist. He insists on seeing the world not primarily as a creation of God, much less as a miracle, but seeing the world as a natural order, a natural development, something that has to be explained through scientific processes. And Darwin, like Hegel and like Nietzsche, sees the world through change. Human beings have not always been here. They are not the measure against which everything else is to be placed. Rather, human beings are a very late development in the evolution of nature, and one should appreciate that man is perhaps not the ultimate stage at all, but only a stepping stone to something else. There's a sense in which Nietzsche would approve not only of the naturalism in the historical sense, but even, again, of the kind of conflict theory that is behind Darwin. And with this in mind, it's rather surprising that one of the themes in Darwin which Nietzsche is most vigorously against is precisely the theme which now is emphasized the most, and that is the theme of natural selection, the survival of the fittest. He says, for example, in an aphorism called Anti-Darwin, this is late in his career in Twilight of the Idols, he says, "As for the famous struggle for existence, so far it seems to me to be asserted rather than proved. It occurs, but it is an exception. It is really a struggle for power." Now, on the one hand, what Nietzsche is doing is saying that the so-called survival of the fittest, that natural selection, is a thesis which hasn't been fully established. In fact, you have many people today, creationists in particular, who argue a similar thesis, though, of course, not with Nietzsche's punchline. It's not that they want to say that really it's all a struggle for power. But what Nietzsche is doing here is raising a kind of objection which I think, looking at Darwin, one has to say is probably unfair. Reading Darwin's second book, less known than Origin of Species, The Descent of Man, the interpretation that's often placed on that and the interpretation which Darwin himself seems to allow is a kind of teleological view. Or, in other words, it's not just natural selection, but nature ultimately has a purpose, and that purpose is man. Darwin clearly did not believe that, but nevertheless, he was also writing at a time when you had to be a bit careful. And there's an ambiguity in his works that has to be unsorted. And for Nietzsche, the unsorting all takes a harsh and critical direction. he interprets Darwin as just another English theologian, basically, who is also interested in naturalism. And he interprets what Darwin is doing as really just saying, look, there's this change through history, and it goes about by this fairly violent process called natural selection, but here we are at the end of it. Here we are as human beings. Darwin, of course, has much more to say about that, but what Nietzsche does is he says, the idea of natural selection is itself bogus and unestablished. Now, trying to understand why he would say this. There was a movement, even in Darwin's time, but it certainly took off at the end of the 19th century and became epidemic at the beginning of the 20th, which is called social Darwinism. It's the idea that in society, as well as in nature, only the fittest shall survive, and that's a good thing. And so it becomes not so much a biological theory as a moral theory. Social Darwinism, as its most vicious, as it is espoused, for example, by the infamous John Rockefeller, is the view that people should be left to their own devices, and those that perish were probably meant to perish. It's a good thing. And those that survive, those that flourish, that's what they were meant to do, and that's a good thing. It is a very harsh doctrine, and despite Nietzsche's reputation for harshness, despite his unabashed elitism, it's not Nietzsche's doctrine at all. And Nietzsche very clearly wanted to dissociate himself from it. The Darwinist views applied to human society often come out vicious, and Nietzsche had a much more artistic, much more elevated sense. His elitism was an artistic, an aesthetic elitism. His notion was not simple survival. It certainly wasn't a matter of making a lot of money, but rather his notion was creativity and artistry. And what he was talking about was the survival of those who are not the most fit, but rather those who are the most creative, those who are the most original. And there we can see what's the problem in thinking about Darwin's notion of natural selection. Because, as Nietzsche points out in many different places, it's not as if what comes out of natural selection is the best we have to find, the best that humanity has to offer, but often what comes out of natural selection is the weakest, or the most repulsive, or the most common. Looking to nature, one can have in mind, for example, that if we're looking for what is the most fit and consequently the most flourishing creature in nature, it would probably be something like the cockroach. Or as one English wit once said, if God is behind evolution, he must have been very fond of beetles. The basic idea being that evolution does not favor what's best, and what is the most fit may nevertheless not be what is best at all. When we turn to Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra, we see this played out in a very graphic way. Just to repeat something that Kathy has already talked about briefly, Nietzsche gives us in the prologue of that work two different images, both of them potential outcomes of human evolution. The first, and by far the most famous, is the Übermensch, the Superman, that to which man is only a bridge from the ape to the Übermensch. The Übermensch is, to be sure, something higher than human beings. It is a creature with virtues that perhaps we cannot even imagine. It is a creature that is devoid of all those aspects that Nietzsche condemns, or at least says bad things about, that he calls human all too human. But this is only one possible alternative. History isn't written yet, there is no teleology, and just as man is not the final stage, neither can we assume that the Übermensch is the final stage or even the next stage. The alternative, of course, is the creature that Nietzsche calls the last man. Again, it's a kind of slap at utilitarianism. The last man, Kathy described rightly as the ultimate couch potato. It is someone who is just perfectly content being who he or she is. We can imagine sitting on the couch, watching TV, eating pretzels or chocolates, maybe sipping some beer, but someone with no aspirations, no creativity, no originality. And this, too, is one of the possibilities of evolution. And Nietzsche, placing his bets, says the last man will probably win. Because if we're thinking in natural selection terms, it's the last man who is probably fitter, that is, more survivable, than the Übermensch, who, after all, is a rare being and, because of the rarity, probably very vulnerable. We find evolution operating also in Nietzsche's theory of knowledge. I suggested there that his arguments about truth, confusing and sometimes contradictory as they may be, ultimately give rise to one dominant picture, and that is that what we call truth, in fact, are those beliefs which best lead to human survival. And he says in various ways, those that we call truths may in fact be our most necessary errors, or what Kant called synthetic a priori, in other words, necessary truths, in fact might be just those beliefs that we can't throw off, but nevertheless, not for that matter true, but rather possibly false. Looking at Nietzsche as an evolutionist in this regard, one can say that what evolution contributes to the theory of knowledge is it tells us why we believe the things we believe, not by way of justifying those beliefs, much less by way of showing the facts to which they refer, but rather by saying, here is the place they play in a flourishing human life, and that's why we believe them. Now, history itself fascinates Nietzsche, but one has to say that he also saw the dangers of history. In an early essay called The Use and Disadvantage of History for Life, one of the untimely meditations in the early 1870s, what he argued was that history, while a fascinating subject and something that in many ways is an invaluable subject, is also a great danger. And it's very clear that what he was talking about here was his scholarly brethren, the philologists and historians he worked with at the university, who had essentially buried themselves away from life, many cases sacrificed family, friends, social life in general, other creative and artistic interests, just for the sake of their classics or just for the sake of the archives and historical research. For such people, Nietzsche points out, history has become a kind of death. It is another version of the otherworldly. It is a way of escaping from this life and, in this case, retreating to another one. In this case, the other world is the world of the past. And so history can be very disadvantageous for life, a great danger. And Nietzsche himself, as a philologist, someone who is enamored, enraptured by the ancient Greeks, wanted to be very clear that one cannot lose oneself in the ancient world. And of course, he says, one cannot simply go back to it. So the question is, while history is absolutely essential for understanding the emergence of humanity and possible future, for history is absolutely essential for understanding knowledge and what we believe, while history is absolutely essential for understanding our institutions, like religion and morality. Nevertheless, history is not an end in itself. We live not in order to do history, but rather history must serve life. And the truth is that Nietzsche tells us, as he saw in his colleagues, is that history can be an enormous disadvantage. Not just because we might lose ourselves in it as scholars or as philologists, but for everyone, and this was probably true of much of the Germany he knew, there's a sense that the other people, the people of the past, the ancient Greeks in particular, had done so well, were such perfect specimens of humanity, that we ourselves are pathetic, and why try to even approach them? Or there's the idea that history is a kind of embarrassment, that if we look at our past, we can't really live with ourselves. And if you look at some of the debates we have about recent American history, for example, the Civil War, about slavery, about the bombing of Japan, what you see is that there's just this debate going on. We have to whitewash history in order to live with ourselves. And if we really took the truth in its bold version, we would be too humiliated, too embarrassed, too ashamed to go on. So what Nietzsche is trying to do, both in this early essay and in his later works, is to find a perspective within which to view history, such that history really does serve life. He finds, in this early essay, three such possibilities. The first is what he calls monumental history. It's the way of looking at history as, for example, we might look back at Stonehenge or the Parthenon or perhaps even the Vatican and say, look what people have done before us. And in the realm of literature, what we look at for the most part are not the bestsellers, the trash novels, or poetry, or epics of ancient times and medieval times, but we look back at the best works, the ones that say, in effect, here is what humanity can do, Homer being a prime example. So monumental history, in this sense, shows us the possibilities. It shows us what we as human beings can do, and consequently it spurs us on to do similar things now and in the future. The second mode of history that Nietzsche praises is what he calls antiquarian history. And one has to be very careful with this term. He was a philologist, and of course there's a sense in which he loved the antiquities. But it would be a mistake to think of antiquarian history as what he condemns as getting lost in the past. Rather, antiquarian history is a way of appreciating our past. And one has to throw in here that this can be very complicated indeed. In his later works, in particular in Beyond Good and Evil and Genealogy of Morals, he makes it very clear that appreciating our past and appreciating the ancients doesn't involve whitewashing. That when we have a picture, for example, of the ancient Greeks, just in terms of the wisdom of Solon and Pericles, or in terms of the wise philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, or the great artist Praxiteles and so on, who did these wonderful monuments. If we think that's all that Greece was, then we don't understand Greece. The truth is that Greece was a culture steeped in cruelty, and the ancient tragedians, especially the ones that Nietzsche most admired, like Sophocles and Aeschylus, and of course Homer before them, were very articulate about the amount of cruelty and the amount of blood and the amount of tragedy that was involved in this history. So antiquarian history isn't just looking back at the nice parts of ancient history, but rather it's looking at ancient history as it really was and being able to take a kind of pride in that. It's not an unmixed pride, to use the American example again. A history that isn't accurate and fair about the extent and cruelty of slavery in America is absolutely inadequate and these days intolerable. But to think that this is all there is to say about that, and that we therefore must simply condemn ourselves and live in shame, is inadequate too. The truth is, this is our history, this is part of what has made us what we are today, and it is also, in some obvious respects, a heritage that has to be overcome. But it's this whole picture that has to be appreciated and not just a piece of it. And finally, this is what Nietzsche calls critical history. And this, of course, is what he himself engages in brilliantly. It's what a great many historians today, sometimes they consider themselves muckrakers or unveilers, but basically the idea is looking back at history and criticizing what's going on in the past, again, as a lesson for what we can do differently now. The basic picture is that history serves us by providing us examples, by providing us with a heritage, by providing us with targets through which we can rethink and evaluate and live our own lives. Now, there's an underlying value behind all of this, and we have still to talk about it much more. The value is life itself. What does it mean to say history should serve life? And along with that value goes an underlying metaphor. It's one, in fact, that's used by very few philosophers, but certainly in Nietzsche, I would say it is front and center. It's the metaphor of health and sickness. Now, one should keep in mind here, and we'll say this again, that Nietzsche was himself a very unhealthy man, that from the time he fell off the horse while in school and in services, he, from that time on, was someone who was never all well. He had pains, he had insomnia, he had migraine headaches that must have been horrible. He had all sorts of digestive problems and other things that didn't become diagnosed until much later. But he was not a well man. And so certainly in his own consciousness, thinking ad hominem, sickness and health must have been absolutely central to what he thought about philosophy, about movements, and about history. But basically, the idea is that with reference to history, our attitudes to history and the value of history for life is to be measured in these terms. Christianity as a view of history is something that clearly comes out on the unhealthy side. On the other hand, nobility and what he saw and appreciated in the ancient Greeks comes out on the healthy side. And the whole point of genealogy is going to be to separate the healthy from the sick. Thank you.